Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the situation in Egypt on the third anniversary of the revolution that has since been quashed, with a return to military rule that has been going on in Egypt since 1952. Sama Shahata, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, joins us to discuss what kind of support there is for the military who have successfully divided the liberals and Islamists and conquered the hope for democracy that was manifested in Tahrir Square 3 years ago. Then, ahead of the State of the Union address, we will look into President Obama's promise to work with Congress where he can and his threat to bypass Congress in 2014 where he can't, promising, "We're not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure we are providing Americans with the kind of help they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone." Keith Poole, chair of the Department of Political Science in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and author of Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy, joins us to discuss what the president can do to circumvent an implacably hostile Congress. Then finally, we'll speak with Sister Simone Campbell, the executive director of NETWORK, a Catholic social justice lobby. We will discuss growing income and wealth disparity in the U.S. and the world, which the president is supposed to mention in his upcoming State of the Union, and look into what can be done to restore social justice and economic opportunity in a world where just 85 individuals have wealth equal to the combined wealth of 3.5 billion people, half of the world's population. And joining us now is Sama Shahata, who's an associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown's University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sama Shahata.
Thanks for having me back.
And on this third anniversary of the 2011 revolution in Egypt that overthrew President Hosni Mubarak, and a military regime, in effect, that's been running the country since 1952. About 50 people have been killed in clashes today over the last couple of days. And now, of course, they're talking about new elections, and it looks as if they would be elections that would produce Sisi, the current military leader, as the new leader. And there's apparently a tremendous amount of lobbying underway to make General Fatah al-Sisi the new president. Is that your understanding?
Well, he's certainly incredibly popular. He's the Minister of Defense, and I think he also holds the title of Minister of Military Production and Deputy Prime Minister. So many titles. And he, of course, is the one who was responsible for, after millions of people protested at the end of June, last year, ousting democratically elected first civilian president Mohamed Morsi. So yes, there is a great deal of lobbying. That's correct. There are campaigns, popular campaigns, to get him to announce his presidential run, and he is very popular. But as you mentioned, and as is known, he hails from the military. He is the individual who ousted President Morsi, and of course, one wonders what the outcome would be for Egypt and Egyptian democracy if he were to run.
So what happened to the liberals who were the original proponents of the original revolution 3 years ago? They are all but absent. Have they been driven into the shadows?
Say three things, and in order to understand what's been going on in Egypt, I think, properly. The first thing is that, and I've been saying this, and I think many have for quite some time, is that there wasn't a revolution in Egypt in 2011. Millions of people protested. It was incredibly energetic and a wonderful spectacle and, you know, an incredible triumph of the will to have millions of people have sustained protests against an authoritarian regime for 18 days that eventually led to the removal of the head of that regime, Hosni Mubarak. And in fact, it was the military, really, at the end, who pushed him aside, pushed him under the bus to save themselves and to save the regime. And why that's an important distinction is because it wasn't a revolution. They didn't uproot the entire authoritarian infrastructure and institutions that were part of that oppressive regime. They left many of them largely or wholly in place, like the military, like the security services, like the intelligence, like much of the judiciary and so on. And that partially explains the resistance to democracy that we've seen over the last 3 years that have made real democracy, freedom, human rights, rule of law, security sector reform, transitional justice, almost impossible. That's the first point. The second point is, to your question, where have the liberals gone? Well, I think the liberals have gone in two or three places. As you probably know, some of them are in jail now. Some of the youth activists who were really the ones responsible for the uprising in 2011, Ahmed Meher of the April 6th movement, Ahmed Duma, also a blogger and critic and activist and so on, they're now in jail. They've been put in jail over the last few months, charged with violating the new protest law. We like to call it the anti-protest law because it puts so many restrictions on protest that the new government has put in place. So that's, and many others also, some journalists and so on, have been either intimidated or essentially silenced. So that's part of the liberals. And the other part, and this has always been Egypt's dilemma, are either silent or supporting the government now, not because they necessarily are fully happy with it, but because they fear the Islamists. And I like to say that they fear the Islamists more than they like or love democracy and liberalism, right? And that's the dilemma. And so that's really the state of the liberals, and some people say kind of, you know, pseudo-liberals or liberals in quotation marks of in Egypt.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Sama Shahata, who is a Associate Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies, and he's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. So on this third anniversary of the Egyptian uprising, if we can't call it a revolution, just this month, Egyptian voters ratified a new constitution that essentially gives the military, the police, and the intelligence unprecedented power, and they've always been in power. So they've been given a blank check. So when we talk about voters and referenda, I mean, what are the numbers? I mean, there obviously is support for the military, but how can you quantify it?
Well, this is, and you've, again, hit on the right thing. I mean, it is a complicated, not black and white story. And the numbers are the following, you know. 20 million people voted in the referendum for the Constitution on January 14th and 15th. That comes out to about a 38% turnout for registered voters. And of the people who voted, about 97-98% voted yes for the Constitution. Now, to understand the story, of course, you have to remember that the Muslim Brotherhood and others called for a boycott, so they didn't go out even to voice their opinion. And then those who tried to campaign, the few who tried to campaign against the referendum on very legitimate grounds and not necessarily supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, were either silenced and some of them were actually jailed just for campaigning for a no vote. Now, that being said, the civilian military-backed civilian government that's in power now and Minister Sisi are genuinely popular. They're genuinely popular because many Egyptians supported, not all, but many Egyptians supported the ouster of Morsi. The economic situation had deteriorated significantly. There were regular electricity shortages. There were fuel shortages. People had to wait in line for 5 or 6 hours at the gas pump to get gasoline and diesel fuel and so on. And over the spring and summer months, there were regular power outages across the country. The economy had deteriorated. There was a shortage of foreign currency. You couldn't get dollars and so on. Much of this, of course, was produced by elements of the regime precisely to see the demise of Morsi and see people get angry at the current regime. But nevertheless, all of that is a way to say that there is a great deal of support for the current government. Now, of course, there are some huge numbers also of people who are the victims of the current government, but that's the state of Egypt as it is today.
Well, of course, there is this movie, and I know the filmmakers, and it's up for the Academy Award, The Square. and it's banned in Egypt, but apparently it's going to be shown on a jumbotron in Tahrir Square. At least that's my understanding. And it would seem that the U.S. not only, I think, is a news story, it's almost as if we've forgotten about it, but it also appears to me that our government is somewhat lost. They seem to, you know, don't know what to do. Chuck Hagel tries to talk with Sisi, and I don't think he's getting anywhere. And the impression I get is that, and by the way, the Egyptian military regime, through its, you know, control of the press, seem to be just vilifying the U.S. around the clock. Is that your understanding?
Well, yes, there is a great deal of hostility towards not just the American press and so on, but the foreign press and foreign coverage of the situation, because many in Egypt, of course, those supporters of the current government, see critical stories largely in the Western press, and they say, look, you know, you're only reporting on half the picture, or you're reporting a biased perspective. I mean, you're not reporting on the supporters of the current situation. But in any case, you are correct that the United States finds itself in a difficult position, is also acting, I think, inappropriately, and has had inappropriate policies for the last 6, 7, 8 months now with regard to the change of power. I mean, there has been, and to be fair, you know, they don't know what to do, and they have limited effect as well. In other words, they can't kind of control the outcome. But I don't think they've been critical enough, certainly, with the governments in Egypt. They're continuing to supply them economic and military assistance, and their criticism has been muted. And in fact, at times, Secretary Kerry seemed to have indicated that they were making progress on democracy, which is not the case at all, really. So that's the position the United States has been in. It has not really called for an end to military assistance. It has not been harsher in its criticism of the abuses that have taken place and so on.
Well, it seems to me that the real backers, in terms of foreign backers of the Egyptian counter-revolution with the military takeover, have been the Saudis. As soon as the coup took place, the military coup took place, the money poured in from Saudi Arabia. My understanding is that the Saudis also, through their connections with the military, were complicit in all of these shortages of gasoline and diesel that you mentioned earlier, and long lines for food, etc. So is there a shift underway? Because I know that when back in the original revolution or uprising, apparently the Saudi king was on the phone every day to Obama, screaming at him, saying, let Mubarak shoot those kids and squash this revolution. And Obama refused. And so it's pretty clear what the Saudi position is. So is Saudi Arabia now like a big player in this? And by extension, the military regime now put out feelers to Russia. Maybe they'll buy arms from Russia. What's going on there?
Yes, I mean, this is certainly a regional issue. There's no question about that. And from the very beginnings of the Arab uprisings, there were countries in the region who were vehemently against the idea of democracy or holding leaders accountable to the populations and so on. And those countries were the authoritarian states in the region, but particularly in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, some of the other Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates. And, you know, you didn't mention Kuwait, and of course it's an interesting country because there's a significant degree of democratic participation in Kuwait, but the ruling family and the regime itself is against democracy flourishing elsewhere in the region. And so Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait poured in billions of dollars to the tune of $12 billion initially after the ouster of Morsi took place. And several of those countries have committed and given more money to Egypt since. The United Arab Emirates, for example, several billion more dollars. And they are fully supportive of the current regime in Egypt and are opposed to, you know, democracy sweeping over the region, crossing over the Red Sea, and threatening their own regimes. So, yes, there's no question that I think one has to look at the Arab region regionally and see those countries that have been opposed to the development of democracy, and then, you know, maybe the few that have tried to support it. I mean, Tunisia mildly so, and so on.
So, Sami Shahada, do you think that this film, The Square, up for the Academy Awards, and it's likely it might win the Academy Award, it certainly is a powerful piece of work. It tells the whole story of the revolution going back 3 years up to the present. And for all of Morsi and the military's claim that they do not want to harm a single Egyptian, the film makes it clear that that has not been the case, that there have been brutal beatings. And we've seen them shoot people down in the streets, too, at the time of the coup against Morsi. So what's your sense, then, of whether a movie or a documentary feature can make a difference here? Or, in other words, it's as though they are fulfilling their own kind of worst nightmare here, the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood is a part of this Islamist interpretation of democracy, which is one person, one vote, one time. Once they get in, then it's the end of democracy. And it's almost as though they have created their own nemesis here and preempted.
Well, they haven't fully allowed that to take place, right? I mean, you're right that they, you know, that the boogeyman of Islamist politics and takeover and so on has then, you know, subverted the possibility of democracy. And to be fair, you know, the Morsi government was miserable, and Morsi made tremendous mistakes, and there were some authoritarian tendencies and so on. And the constitution that was passed was not a constitution for all Egyptians. It was written by an Islamist-dominated constituent assembly, and it was not really, you know, a pinnacle of democracy and equality for all and so on. With regard to the question, I don't think, unfortunately, and I'm, you know, pessimistic about this, that a film, particularly a kind of foreign-made film, you know, is going to have a huge impact or going to change the course of history in Egypt. I think that it's gotten some attention. You know, it's been in the papers in Egypt, and in fact, it's been in the papers in the Arabic press in Egypt as a film about Egypt that's nominated for this major award that can't be screened in Egypt, right? Mm-hmm. And so on. And I think liberals and intellectuals and so on and activists are going to enthusiastically go out and try to watch the movie. And if it does get screened in Tahrir, there will be people there to watch it and so on. But I don't think it's going to change the course of history in any way inside Egypt.
But the filmmakers are Egyptian, are they not, or Egyptian-American?
I think one of them is, yeah, but the movie isn't, you know, a movie, I think, initially geared for a domestic Egyptian audience. I think it was, which isn't the criticism of the movie. I mean, you know, but nevertheless, I don't think that any film really could have that kind of an impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about here, and I think people forget this, vested political and economic interests of major institutions, and you know, this is quite serious. We're talking about the military, we're talking about military generals, the security establishment, the police, the intelligence, the elements of what we call the deep state in Egypt, really, aren't necessarily elected officials. Not all of them are in the public view, but they were part of and are part of an autocratic system. And they certainly are going to fight. And this is, I think, what people were somewhat naive about when the uprising apparently succeeded with the removal of Mubarak. You know, the beneficiaries of the previous order were not going to sit back and you know, recede into the sunset, right? I mean, they have vested interests at stake, and they've been fighting ever since, and the struggle continues.
And, of course, to some extent, it was the Egyptian military behind the scenes that manipulated those first elections to, you know, to come out with this result of Morsi being the leader and being, the, you know, one of the least effective of the others, you know. And the-
well, I don't think that they manipulated the election results. And remember, the election took place in two stages. In the first round, there were, you know, 12 or so candidates. We didn't really know who were going to be the top two. In fact, all of the polling data got it wrong. People thought that Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister and secretary general of the Arab League, was going to be the front runner. But in fact, and unfortunately for Egyptians, the two most polarizing figures, the two most extreme figures, Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmed Shafiq, Mr. Mubarak's last prime minister, formerly the head of the Air Force, an element of that regime, emerged.
Well, that was my point. That was my point, that, you know, that the more intelligent and moderate Muslim Brotherhood leader didn't make it, and the socialist leader didn't make it, and they came close. And it seemed
you're right, they did come close. And but I think that it was really kind of, you know, just an accident of history, and had to do also with the kind of political structures that existed in Egypt. But you are definitely right that from the moment that Morsi became president and so on, there were many who wanted to see his demise and actively worked for it. I mean, I remember a trip to Egypt, you know, before the ouster in March of 2012, and having been in Egypt for a couple of weeks and meeting people and so on, I was convinced that the so-called liberal and secular opposition were hoping for economic collapse as a way to get rid of Morsi. I mean, it was incredible. Rather than working towards, you know, the possibility of winning in parliamentary elections or something like that, or establishing a grassroots, they were betting on economic collapse and food shortages and so on as a way to get rid of this president. And so, you know, that clearly is not something that's going to deepen democracy and democratic consolidation and the culture of democracy and so on in a place. So,
well, Sami Shahada, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Sami Shahada, who's an associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about whether in the State of the Union the president is going to threaten to bypass the Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Keith Poole, who is a Philip Alston Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and of Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. His latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Good afternoon or good morning, depending on the
time. I'm glad you could join us, Keith, even if you're freezing there. I was just in Washington yesterday, and it was I'm for California now, you know, and I couldn't handle it. But tell me about what you think is going to be happening on Tuesday. There's rumors, and in fact, the president has signaled his spokesperson, his press spokesperson, has signaled that he's going to basically bypass the Congress, work with them where he can, and bypass them where he can't. And there's an expectation in this that in the State of the Union, you're going to see a different Obama, a much more aggressive one, basically saying, I'm fed up with these people. They've done nothing but block me, and I'm going to figure out ways to, you know, govern this country without them. Is it possible?
Well, in some respects, it is, because a lot of times presidents can, especially with a Congress where the two chambers are controlled by different parties, presidents can take actions, and the Supreme Court won't do anything about it because very few people have a standing to sue, and they're on questions like disputes between branches, and the Supreme Court is very reluctant to get in the middle of that. So we'll see. It's a dangerous thing to do because we're going to have an election in the fall, which I think the Republicans are going to make fairly large gains in the Senate, not very big gains in the House. There's just not a whole lot he can do unilaterally about a lot of the big issues. Most of the things that he can do are having his executive branch agencies do rulemaking on various things. So I'm not quite sure what he has in mind. He's probably going to lose in the Supreme Court on the recess appointments, but the court will probably be very reluctant to say that all the rulings that were done, for example, by the National Labor Relations Board are null and void. So I'm not completely convinced that there's a lot that he can do. He's also going to be very distracted, whether he wants to be distracted or not, by foreign affairs, as most presidents are. So we'll just have to wait and see what he has in mind.
Well, apparently, Keith Poole, he's bringing in people from the Clinton administration, including John Podesta, Clinton's former chief of staff, to test the boundaries of executive authority. But given our divided government, what can you get done by executive order?
Not much. And the irony of that is that Clinton got a lot done with the Republican Congress when he was president because the Republican contingents in Congress were much less extreme than they are now. And actually Clinton passed quite a bit of legislation that he wanted. So that I'm not completely sure. I know that Podesta is a pretty tough guy, but you can make certain rulings about immigration that is executive branch can just not enforce some laws, and it's very difficult to make the executive branch enforce a law if it doesn't want to enforce a law. So they can do things like that, but this is just really penny-ante stuff compared to the fundamental problems the country has. And it's not going to do a lot to really get the economy moving. The markets were reacting this week almost entirely to actions of the Federal Reserve Board. So there's not a lot that he can do in terms of getting the economy moving, which is really the key thing, because that's our deficit problems, and I'm mainly referring to entitlement costs, would be if we could get the economy recovering 3 to 4% growth rate, would at least ease some pressure on things. But without that, there's not a lot that he can do.
Again, I'm speaking
In terms of employment.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Keith Poole, who is the chair of the Department of Political Science at the School of Public International Affairs at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. His latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy. So how do you think it would play, though, assuming that some of these reports are correct, that the president is going to show a tougher tone on Tuesday to the very Congress that's been obstructing him all along? And it is, I think it's going down in history as the worst do-nothing Congress. And they've been implacably hostile to him and incredibly disrespectful to him. So I don't think he owes them anything. And it might be refreshing to put them on notice. But do you think it's likely to happen?
Well, he hasn't exactly been playing patty cake with the House Republicans so far. So I guess you could take it up a notch. It's always important to remember that that the real issue here is the switchback of the House to Republican control in the 2010 elections, and because of the extremism of Senate candidates, the Democrats have held on to the Senate. So it's really more of an issue of President Obama versus the Republican House, and they've dialed that up quite a few notches. So I guess you could dial it up even higher. I think the big difference in 2014, though, is going to be the fact that Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader Cantor in the House and their group, along with a fairly substantial number of the House Republican caucus, have figured out that they should just simply get out of the way, because as the health care law continues to roll out, it's going to make more and more people mad. And the Republicans are not, notice they made a very quick deal on spending at $1.1 trillion, and that blew through both House and Senate. And my guess is they will not do anything on the debt ceiling, except maybe a pretty harmless policy rider that's acceptable to the Senate. And other than that, I think they're just simply going to stay out of the way. So the attacks on the House Republicans are going to have to be along the lines that they're not passing legislation rather than blocking legislation, or passing legislation that's entirely symbolic, like trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So, yeah, he can get tougher and tougher and tougher, but I think that the rollout of health care law is something that's going to be, he's just simply not going to be able to avoid that news. And you can see it in the fall in his general support in the population. Mm-hmm. Because there aren't too many things more personal to people than their health care. In the big boulder to the drop is coming, and that is when the employer mandate kicks in. Then large employers, they're not going to drop their insurance, of course, but what will happen is that people who work for large institutions, like me, I work for a big university system, we're not going to lose our health insurance or anything like that, but our premium is going to go up and the deductible is going to go up. And that's not going to make people very happy. So that it's going to be very difficult to distract, unless the Republicans do stupid stuff like, you know, lies from the pits of hell and I don't know, some jerk mumbled something, went on about how a woman's supposed to serve her husband or some damn thing.
Right. Oh, and that women's libido.
That sort of nonsense. It's going to be very difficult to change the focus of the coming campaign.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to your latest book here, Keith Poole. And by the way, I spent the last few days in Washington at a conference on health care reform and rolling out Obamacare, and Everything I heard was the opposite, that the more people experience Obamacare, the more they're going to like it. So you obviously have a different opinion here. But I'm interested in your new book, Political Bubbles, Financial Crisis and the Failure of American Democracy. Is it a case, really, that that the financial elite run America and that we have a kind of kabuki theater going on there in Washington?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's not just, it's the Frontline, PBS Frontline, which can hardly be accused of being Fox News, has run a number of pieces on it. There was an Academy Award-winning documentary several years ago called Inside Job. And we document this in some detail in our book, only we look at the political side in addition to the economic side. And basically the moneyed elites essentially run both parties in the sense that if you look at campaign contributions, they're increasingly from the rich and about equally divided between the two political parties. The two political parties have essentially equal numbers of billionaires and rich donors, and something like 1/100% of campaign donors now are comprised something way north of 47%, I forget the number, of total campaign donations. And what's interesting is that it's the small donors that are giving to the crazies, that is the people way out in the extreme right or the extreme left, are primarily driven by the small donors, whereas the very rich are donating right around the average Democrat and the average Republican. But the other way that the moneyed interests manifest themselves is the fact that former executives in the executive branch and important players in Congress and their staffers go back into the financial industry, mm-hmm. just like the recent departure of the
Sean.
Head of President Obama's budget office.
Right, the revolving door. Well, Keith Bull, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I really thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who is the chair of the Department of Political Science at the School of Public International Affairs at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he is the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. And his latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Sister Simone Campbell, who I spoke with on Friday in Washington, D.C. at a forum on healthcare reform.
And not your pride. We can go on and keep pretending. Oh, please, Mr. President.
Oh, Mr. President.
Where's all the money you spend?
All the money that you spend.
Food is running low. And they have nowhere to go. Quit slowing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, broadcasting from Families USA Health Action Forum 2014 from Capitol Hill. And joining me now is Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network. She's also a lawyer, an advocate, and a poet.
Yes.
Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Simone Campbell.
Great to be with you.
And it's great to see you in person.
I know. What a treat.
We've spoken a lot on the phone, and I've enjoyed our conversations. In terms of getting the Affordable Care Act up and running. Of course, you had were very instrumental in getting it passed through the Congress. You saw that
initially,
whole
yes.
unpleasant sausage making there, and it came down to the wire. It was your letter that got it passed.
Well, our letter certainly helped. It was signed by 59 Catholic sisters, heads of their religious communities, who said the Affordable Care Act was a good way forward. And the real controversy was that some staff in the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops was saying that there was federal funding of abortion in the bill. There's not. And two federal courts have now found, as a matter of law, our analysis was correct. And so I feel vindicated both by the courts and by the fact that now this good step forward is being implemented. It's a huge honor to have done that work.
And Bart Stupak was very key, was he not?
It was absolutely key.
And it was his religious beliefs that you...
Well, it was interesting. It was his faithfulness that was a part of it, but it was also the faith of many other members of Congress. A lot of people don't realize that over 25% of Congress are Roman Catholic. And mm-hmm. so what... Their faith matters to them, and so I've heard from many members of Congress that they were so grateful for the letter because it gave a different perspective, and that they had worried that voting against the bishop's position would be a problem. They thought the bill was okay, but having us come out say, yes, we've read the bill, it's fine. There is no federal funding of abortion, gave them a clarity of conscience that allowed them to. Congressman Stupak was one. He was a key leader of trying to make it happen, but there were many more that were affected.
But you led the nuns on the bus and went to Paul Ryan's district, and of course he ran for vice president on the Republican ticket. Have you been able to persuade him? He's coming up with apparently a Republican version of the Affordable Care Act, which seems a little bit late in the day, frankly.
It does seem a bit late, but the Republicans seem a little slow on this whole process of health care reform, but better late than never, maybe. But actually, his approach is so individualistic and so focused not on community, but on private gain, that he really misses the whole idea of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is about us being in this together. We share responsibility for each other. And he doesn't seem to have that in his
mind. So in other words, not enough Jesus and too much Ayn Rand? Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, I believe. I wouldn't say it that way, but I think I agree with your analysis, yes.
But let's turn to John Kasich, because he's an example of somebody whose faith the right thing, right?
Absolutely.
As opposed to the governor of Texas and the governor of Wisconsin, which I cannot for the life of me understand how these governors could deny basic health care for millions of their citizens based on their own personal ideology. And I think even more and more unacceptable is that apparently it's their private political ambitions are at stake. They think that if they're going to run for president, they've got to show that they're tough on the poor, you know.
Well, and this is the whole thing that's corrupting our society, our democracy, I believe, at this point in, is that it is this fear of the far right, this fear that someone will sabotage my personal ambition, and that fear is stronger than a concern for all our people. The fact that people within 133% of poverty cannot get health care in our country, I mean, this is wrong in the richest nation on earth. In my Bible, I carry this picture of Margaret, who died in 2012 because she lost her job in the recession. When she lost her job, she lost her health care. She had a propensity for colon cancer, and by the time she finally went to an emergency hospital, she was terminally ill. And she died unnecessarily because she didn't have health care. If the Affordable Care Act was fully implemented with Medicaid expansion, Margaret could have gotten treatment and would be alive today and a contributing member to our society. To me, that is not only my pro-life stance that no more Margaret should die, but it's also about we're a nation that's better than that. We need our people to be able to contribute. And focusing just on political gain to the detriment of your citizens, of your state, that's wrong. That is just flat-out wrong.
Well, Sister Simone Campbell, we've seen this sort of jihad against the Affordable Care Act, the relentless opposition, 42 times in the House they tried to vote
Isn't
it down.
Isn't that absurd?
I mean, it certainly entered the realms of the absurd, but that's not to say that in this political year it will not continue to be a political football. What's your sense, though? And I suspect that in many ways the opposition to it is based upon the fear that it just might work.
It's going to work. Absolutely. Right. I was just at a university giving a talk in their winter commencement, and an adjunct faculty came up to me and gave me a card and asked her business card and asked me to carry to my Bible for her sake of her husband and her two young kids, because she's an adjunct faculty. She never had been able to have health insurance. He was self-employed, and they got health insurance through the exchange. They got through the exchange and were finally able to afford health insurance. Christmas, before the health insurance kicks in, he got taken to the emergency in an ambulance. He ends up being diagnosed with cancer. But now, finally, because there's no exclusion for a pre-existing condition, and they finally can afford coverage, he's going to get treatment and still be there to care for his kids in the future. I mean, that's the right thing to do. So I think it's working. And the reason why we're hearing all this bad news is because that's the only thing the Republicans hope to scuttle it politically, but it's not good for our people. So.
Well, but let's face it, the three pillars of the foundation in our Constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, arguably, and, you know, if health, I would say, is intimately connected to life.
Absolutely.
And intimately connected to happiness. And maybe it's being the liberty part's being misinterpreted by the libertarians, but, you know.
Well, I think the liberty part gets misinterpreted because they think of it as just individual, me and mine. And that the idea that we live in a society, a complex society like ours, and I can just take care of myself. Excuse me, we're sitting in a building that other people built. It's all about community. That's where we've gone wrong. And so that liberty is about how we can live in community confident that we'll care for each other. I am my sister's keeper. I am my brother's keeper. And so are you. So we need to do this together. That's where we run amok.
Well, in terms of individualism versus community, is that in any way an explanation for the growing disparity in wealth? I must say I find it extraordinary that we've reached the point in this country where just one family, the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart family, own wealth that's the equivalent to 40% of all of the American households at the lower 40%. Now we also find out that just 85 individuals have the combined wealth equal to that of half of the world's population. That's 3.5 billion people. Just 85 people. This, to me, should be the issue of our day.
Well, absolutely. And it's the issue we think is the coming issue that we've got to address. Because, and it's wonderful because Pope Francis, who spoke on this, has said that it is this income and wealth disparity that is the source of violence in our society. It's the erosion of our sense of collaboration with each other. And it's causing us to decimate the earth because we think we have a right to suck everything out of the earth and no thought for the generation that come after us. So for us at Network, it is the key to moving forward. We've had this program that we call Mind the Gap. We've been doing it since 2011. And in 2011, we submitted a petition to the White House saying, hold a summit on income disparity in our nation. And it's taken a little longer than I thought to get the attention of the president, but he's talking about it. So I think we're making progress, but it is shocking. It's eroding our relationship with each other. And we've got to change it. It's wrong. It need not happen. It need not happen.
But given that there's only 85 people involved, it would seem to be attainable. If you could meet with 85
exactly.
people on this planet.
I want to make a house call. Don't you?
Go ahead.
Let's go.
We'll draw up a list.
Exactly. A pastoral visit. See,
right.
Because this is it. The thing that I know because of faith, okay, I do this politics part because of the Constitution, but because of faith, what I know from the gospel is the example of Jesus is all about touching the pain of the world and let your heart be broken. Let your heart be broken open. But too often, very wealthy people get insulated from the pain of the world, so they never have a chance to have their heart broken open. So they're not aware of their relationship with others. They get too, I think those 85 probably don't know the joy of Southwest Airlines or Greyhound Bus. So I really think getting greater connection with real people could aid them in their own development.
But isn't human connection at the heart of so much of how our society's changed in the sense that we are drifting apart and becoming atomized. I mean, if you, how many times have you seen at a restaurant three or four people sitting down at a table all on their cell phones?
I know, doesn't that?
How many times?
Do you think they're texting each other? I don't know.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary. And I think that with children obsessed with video games, with children being babysat by television, do you think that in many ways we're losing our humanity because of that? Where our society is evolving around atomization and isolation as opposed to community?
Well, I think it's a pendulum swing. And I think it sort of started with, in our nation, with Ronald Reagan and that whole idea of the Wild West was only built by an individual. And now I think the pendulum's coming back. I mean, I goof around and say, you know, the Bay of Fundy, where the tide goes so far out that it you know, all the boats get marooned on the mud flats. Well, even in the Bay of Fundy, the tide does change. So I think we're beginning to see the turning of the tide and that we can make a difference. We have enough time to make a difference.
But in terms of technology, I mean, are we becoming slaves to it, and is it having a detrimental effect? I mean, if we are indeed, one of the things that I understand from my adventures into trying to understand economics and macroeconomics and what's happening, and we've talked about the biggest issue of all, the increasing gap between the rich and the poor. It does seem that jobs are becoming obsolete. And one of the reasons why our middle class is so distressed and working Americans are finding it so hard to have a living wage, that what we do effectively is we export jobs and, in effect, import cheap labor. And one of the arguments I've heard is that, well, jobs are becoming obsolete. You know, that when we export our jobs abroad, we replace them with robots. So it would seem to me that if this is inexorable and it's going to be difficult for all, we have so many challenges, is there a way to rethink work, that maybe work could involve more of what you do, in other words? You know, in other words, we don't all have to punch the time clock at a factory or go into a big insurance building or something. Maybe there's other things that we can do.
There's work to be done if we would only value it. I think one of the mistakes we've made is by valuing we shift the money to the top in a shareholder-driven perspective of short-term profit. There's plenty of work to be done. Look at our schools. We need more people in the schools working with kids and helping them learn to read and to think. People are just not thinking. I was just at a university yesterday, and one of the things, the written goal was for me to give a talk about politics and help the students think about diversity of perspective, because it didn't usually happen. And then I realized, well, I listen to the news that I like best, PBS, NPR, but other people listen to Fox or MSNBC. We don't cross-pollinate. We need a lot of work to be done to cross-pollinate so we learn to think and how do we talk to each other. There's tons of work to be done, but we don't value it enough to pay for it. And therein lies the trouble. Instead of shifting money to the shareholders or the CEOs, we need to use our money to improve we the people. That's where it's at.
Well, in fact, there's a term for what you're talking about. It's called reality shopping.
Ah.
That liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, and so on and so forth, and that there is no consensus on what's true anymore.
That's true.
Town square.
That's right. We don't have to engage with each other.
Right.
So I've started advocating this thing that I call grocery store missionary work. When we're standing in line in the grocery store, don't talk about sports or the coming Super Bowl or any of that. Instead, say something important to the person behind you or in front of you. Say, have you thought about immigration reform? Or do you worry about these 85 people that have as much wealth as the half the world? Talk about something real. It's a great opportunity. The line never lasts too long, so if it's a bad conversation, you can get out of it soon enough. But what I've discovered is everybody has a thought about it. I've never had somebody say, no, I hadn't thought about it. Everybody's got a thought, but we just don't ask each other.
Well, one of the odd paradoxes of America is that some of the people who are most addressing the subjects that we've been talking about, income disparity, curiously enough, have been among the wealthiest Americans, like Warren Buffett, who has warned that we are becoming a plantation economy. And if indeed it seems to be the case, we're heading into a kind of new feudalism, what I notice that's concurrent with the new economic feudalism is a social form of celebrity worship, which reminds me of what you're talking about being lining up at the supermarket. Because do you look at? People magazine. Obama's having an affair. I mean, and Michelle's angry. I mean, all this insane stuff that they make up, you know. But celebrity worship is so much a part of our culture. Do you think that is becoming a kind of palliative?
Well, that's an interesting issue. I haven't really thought about it. I must say that I've got some notoriety. It's always a shock to me that people say, oh, you're such like a rock star, all this stuff. It's like nuts. I'm still me. I'm the same person. And I'm imperfect. We have problems, but we don't like to see that people are human. But the glory of humanity is that we're all flawed. So I need you. You need me. We're in this together. And the beauty is that we complement each other. But if we've just got celebrities, they're like so rarefied, so out of there, we don't know how we're connected. It's a worry. It's a worry. But it's a substitute for real friends.
Well, that's what I noticed when out in Los Angeles, this young actor who's famous for these race car films, Fast and Furious series, he was killed in a horrible car accident.
I remember that.
But what happened was, for days and days and weeks afterwards, hundreds of people would go and stand around the spot where he died, and they interviewed all these people on television, and they were talking about as though this person who died was their friend, and they had no connection to them. But my sense was, my God, you know, you've got substitute friends instead of real friends.
I do think that's a worry. I mean, people follow me on Facebook, and it worries me that I've got, I don't know, 6,000 friends and 8,000 Twitter followers. Twitter's okay by me because it's all about policy, but the friending part, it's a question.
Right.
It's a question.
Well. So just in closing then, let's try and sort of wrap up all of our challenges here, now that we've had this conversation, now that I'm feeling kind of weary.
Oh, no, don't feel weary. We're really making progress because the tide is turning. The fact that we're talking about poverty, we're talking about income disparity, we're talking about all of the amazing things that the Affordable Care Act is accomplishing with its warts and all. We're also talking about the fact that we know in a globalized economy, we the people need to promote a sense of peace and collaboration. The fact that we're making progress with peace with Iran after all these years, that's huge progress. A lot of good stuff's happening. Yeah, we still got work to do. People are afraid of each other. We do it on electronically. Well, let's use the electronic media, and my idea is to infiltrate the ranks. Kind of seduce them into meeting real people. So I often tweet out, or sometimes tweet out, well, come meet my people. Come on. Come meet them. And that way we create the relationship. So we're doing the best we can. But I think we have to be careful to not to get into old people syndrome. Oh, hell in a handbasket. Think we're going to hell in a handbasket. The fact is, there's a lot of youth. There's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of opportunity. We can do all right. We'll do all right.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. Sister Simone Campbell.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, who is the executive director of Network, a lawyer, advocate, and poet. And by the way, in your new book, are we going to see some of your poetry?
Yes, 14 of my children, my poems will be in it. Yes.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Sister Simone Campbell, who is the head of Network, a Catholic social justice organization. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rosschert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.